This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. The fundamental question of whether economic growth can continue on a planet with finite resources is one that's hotly debated among scientists and economists. Could the capitalist economy bear solutions to our staggering environmental problems such as species loss and catastrophic climate change? Or rather, is capitalism itself essentially the problem? What about green growth, the idea that capitalism and technological innovations can lead to more sustainable practices? And how do working hours and productivity factor into the whole discussion about reducing carbon emissions? Today on the program, we're airing a lecture by Juliet Shore. Shore is a professor of sociology at Boston College, and she taught economics at Harvard University for 17 years. She has published several best-selling books about work practices, well-being, and the environment, including The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure, and more recently, Plentitude, The New Economics of True Wealth, published in 2010. Shore is co-founder of the Center for a New American Dream, a national sustainability organization. Just a note, during her talk, Professor Shore does refer to a few visual slides. You can find links to her reports and publications on her website, julietshore.org. Juliet Shore spoke to an audience of students and faculty at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on February 28, 2014.
I probably, for this audience, don't need to say a lot about what's going on with climate, but it's probably always, you know, worth just reminding ourselves as we go about our daily lives that we are facing a really significant crisis in terms of human impacts on the climate. And if we continue on the so-called business as usual path without addressing the greenhouse gas emissions and changes in land use that are contributing to anthropogenic climate, global warming and climate change, we are going to have a civilizational catastrophe on our hands, and we are already seeing the first steps of that. So this is just to remind us, CO2 concentrations associated with rising temperatures. This is mean temperatures. These are temperature anomalies. So we have here in the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, unusually cold temperatures and over the last 50 years or so, increasingly high temperatures. And of course, we know now with, 95% certainty that this is due to the rise of carbon emissions. These are global carbon emissions. I think everyone's aware of what's happening with carbon emissions. What might be sort of less well known is what is happening to the rate of change of carbon emissions. And you can see from about the time when the world started to pay attention to this problem, from the 70s to the 80s, you have a decline in the rate of growth of carbon emissions. That's the red scale here. But beginning in the 2000s, we see that the annual rate of change of global carbon emissions has intensified and gone from about 1% to 3%. And this is extremely worrisome and very important that we turn this change around and start to get off a path of rising emissions. And, you know, I think as people know, I'm sure you're all paying attention to this, we have a short period of time in which we can act so as to prevent some of the worst impacts from getting locked into the climate system. Climate change is one of a number of environmental problems. This is a probably another diagram that people are familiar with. This came from Johan Rockström and a worldwide team of ecologists and scientists and some economists that was published in Nature in 2009. And it was an attempt to recast a debate that had the terminology had been sort of symbolically corrupted or devalued, and that is the idea of limits to growth. I'm going to say another thing about it in a minute. So instead of limits to growth, they decided to use a new term, planetary boundaries, but it's the basically the same idea, asking the question of what are human activities doing to basic processes of the biosphere, and they looked at biodiversity, atmospheric aerosol loading, carbon, chemical pollution, toxics, climate change, ocean acidification, etc. And, you know, you can see the diagram's pretty self-explanatory. The green area is what's called the sort of safe operating space of humanity, that what we're doing is within the limits of what the biosphere can tolerate and still reproduce these basic ecosystems more or less unproblematically. Red, of course, indicates danger. We have a couple of areas, these three, in which we are well past the safe operating zone, and we have another on which we're getting close. And there, these two, actually, they were unable to quantify them. The data on the toxics is not good. So the point is that climate change is one of a number of environmental problems where we are either nearing or past the point of sustainability. Ecologists and ecologically oriented social scientists call this idea also overshoot, the idea that we are putting more pressures on the planet's ecosystems than is compatible with the reproduction of those ecosystems or with sustainability. I mean, that's obviously what the term sustainability means. I guess the other point to make, which is not reflected in a diagram like this, is that climate change absolutely kind of very potently intersects with a lot of these others. I mean, with virtually all of them, it affects ocean ecosystems, it affects biodiversity, etc. So what does economics and social science more generally, and I'm going to talk about economics and sociology here in the next few minutes, what do these disciplines have to say about this and how do they think about it? So the first point I would say, the sort of the views break down into two major camps, not surprisingly. One is that growth is good, and the process of growth itself and the sort of capitalist, basic processes of the capitalist economy hold the solution to these problems. And the second is that those basic structures and processes are the problem. So in the first camp, we have the so-called environmental Kuznets curve from economics. The environmental Kuznets curve basically just takes the Kuznets curve, which, you know, all the economists in the room know very well what that is. The Kuznets curve is a relationship between growth and inequality, and it's the idea that when societies start to, quote-unquote, develop, so when they get into an industrial or a capitalist growth process, the first thing that happens is inequality increases. So China's a great example of this. As it began to marketize its society, you get increases in inequality. But not to worry, over time, as income rises, then political processes, Hinckley-style things happen, political processes develop that redress that inequality. And so there's a point of inflection here, and eventually you get more growth is associated with less inequality. And that's, economists kind of wave their hands a bit about exactly how it happened. Political scientists spend more time. But it's the idea that in order to solve the problem, you have to go farther into the process that you are in, as opposed to, oh, look, growth is causing a lot of inequality. We need to do something about it. So the idea is that inequality is a normal good, and the richer you get, the more of it you want to buy as a society. So the same argument was applied to the environment. And of course, we know that environmental degradation increases a lot in countries that are in a development process. Increasing rates of growth lead to environmental degradation, and then the idea is that citizens will start to mobilize and organize against that. They will demand better environmental laws, they will demand control of pollution and so forth, and more growth will lead to lower environmental degradation. And this theory was originally developed to look at particular gases. Sulfur dioxide was the first gas that looked at. So sort of very limited particular pollutants, for example, which where you could see some evidence for this. But it turns out that if you look at the big environmental problems that we face today, particularly the global problems, climate change, biodiversity, et cetera, there's really no evidence for the Kuznets curve. Now, one reason people may argue is that the story that was told about why this happens was a national political story, and you have a national state. In the case of climate change, you don't have a global state that can do it. You might want to resurrect your theory that way. But in any case, what happens with greenhouse gas emissions is that the more you grow, the more you emit. So there is no turning point. There is no Kuznets curve. And I'm going to come back to this in a bit. In sociology, the growth is good, and growth is the path to environmental sustainability. Goes by under a theory called ecological modernization, basically the idea that the more modernized, more technologically advanced a society is, the more its businesses and state and eventually its citizens, households, will begin to incorporate principles of what we might think of as environmental rationality so that they will green themselves. The idea of the business, the greening of business, is an ecological modernization idea. It's pretty much standard modernization theory, perfectly analogous to Kuznets' curve, thinking about it more at the level of technology and organization. So more modern equals more green, and the idea is that we should expect that we are going to become more and more sustainable. Certainly, if you look at the data, I mean, I only gave you a few snapshots of data at the beginning, but you know, we could spend many hours looking at what's happening to ecosystems around the world, as well as the climate system. The idea that we are getting more sustainable is very difficult to sustain, because in fact, on pretty much all the indicators and all the big studies of this, whether it's the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, other comparable studies, do not show a process of movement towards sustainability, quite the reverse. So we are degrading the planet, and in some increasingly, and at an increasing rate in some cases.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Juliet Shore is a professor of sociology and economics at Boston College. She spoke earlier this year about decarbonizing the economy. Stay with us. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, we're airing a recorded talk by Juliet Shore. She's a professor of sociology and economics who spoke about economic theories for how to manage carbon emissions for reducing environmental degradation and climate change.
The other version of this, the sort of most recent one, is the idea of green growth. Again, basically the same idea that we can continue to expand the economy more or less under the same kinds of principles that we have been using, and that we can do that sustainably. And you know, the World Bank is very much in the business of promoting a green growth agenda. This is the this decade's version of sustainable development, which came up in the 1980s, Brundtland Commission, and so forth. And the Rio Plus 20 meeting that happened in 2012. At that meeting, the UN also firmly put its feet in the camp of green growth. Ban Ki-moon being from Korea, Korea being one of the major advocates of the green growth agenda on the world scale. So that's one side. The other side is arguing that growth itself is a problem, and that we at the moment do not have a model that allows us to expand the size of the economy and solve our ecological problems at the same time. Many of these sort of growth critics use, you know, the classic IPAT formulation. It's going to come back in my model in a few minutes. This is from biologist Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren, Obama's leading science advisor. basically just breaking down ecological impact into population, income per head, and technology, where technology is just a kind of a matrix of that relates GDP to environmental outcomes. And nobody ever measures that. That's just the residual. I mean, in this literature, nobody ever mentions it. We do have measures of, you know, input-output matrices that give us environmental outcomes. So this kind of framework is very much within that limits to growth idea, the idea that it's industrial production itself, or not just industrial production anymore, that was the terminology they used, but production itself, which has a heavy footprint, roundly criticized by economists, this limits to growth idea. The alternative to ecological modernization in sociology is the treadmill of production story, which is a kind of Marxist story about capitalism needs to grow, and when it grows, it degrades. And now a group of people that go under a number of different terms, I'll just call them a degrowth contingent, beginning to make critiques of growth on ecological grounds and on some others, which I will mention in a minute. So one of the arguments of the degrowth folks, which counters a lot of the optimism from the pro-growth, either the green growth or the Kuznets curves or the eco-modernization folks, is the idea that technology can drastically reduce the environmental impact per unit of production. And so if you think about the debate, both on climate and on other ecological issues, but climate especially, it's been largely a debate about technology, particularly in this country. So we really don't talk about demand for energy. We talk about what kind of energy we use. And the idea is that technology will solve our ecological problems. So rebound effects, or Jevons paradox, of course, remind us that what efficiency does is reduce the effective price of the good or service, in this case, energy, and that efficiency improvements may lead to increased demand for the good or service, because through standard substitution effects, it's now cheaper. And this is one of the things certainly we've seen in a lot of the areas where we've had big efficiency improvements in the United States since the 1970s. After the oil embargo and the big increases in the price of oil, we had big increases in energy efficiency in household appliances and transportation, in residential energy use, and in all of those cases, we've seen increases in demand. So we got much more efficient refrigerators, and what happened? People bought bigger fridges, and they bought multiple fridges. We have much more efficient cars in terms of miles per gallon. What did they do? They switched up to SUVs, and vehicle miles traveled increased all the way into the mid-2000s. Aviation's another great example. There's been a lot of improvement in fuel efficiency in aviation. Price of airline travel fall, huge increase in the amount of airline travel. So the question of how big these rebound effects are and whether actually you get larger demand once you start to take into account not just the micro effects but the macro impacts is a matter of considerable debate in the literature. But rebound effects are really important, and they're one of the things that degrowth folks worry about. So the real crux of the issue between the pro and the anti-growth camps is what's called decoupling. And that means the decoupling of environmental impact from economic activity, or from, let's just call it, from GDP. If you believe in green growth, you have to believe that you can decouple those things so that you can continue to expand but reduce your ecological impact, because right now we are at unsustainable levels of ecological impact. So we've got to be able to continue to grow and reduce our carbon emissions, not just fewer per dollar of GDP, and that's called relative decoupling, so that the carbon intensity of a dollar of production declines, or the material intensity of a dollar of production declines, i.e. a dollar of GDP declines, but also what's called absolute decoupling, so that you are actually reducing impact at the same time that you are expanding output. And that's pretty much, I mean, if you want to boil it down to what the conflict between the two schools is, it hinges on that question. The science folks like to say you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. I mean, you know, that's been repeated by physicists a million times. And of course, the economists like to say, of course you can have infinite growth on a finite planet, because it's not growth of resources we're talking about, it's growth of this monetary unit, growth in value. And the economists are right if you could actually dematerialize GDP, so that you could increase GDP without increasing resources. So what is the evidence? So there's that sort of, you know, at the level of logic or theory, that's really what it's about. What is happening in terms of actual outcomes? And I think we also have to remember outcomes within a particular time frame. So not in some, you know, Keynesian long run, which really, we're going to be dead in the long run, as we're all dead in the long run, as Keynes said, with climate change, we may all be dead in the long run if we don't solve it. But within the time scale that we're talking about. So far, most of the studies, the literature on decoupling shows we're not getting absolute decoupling for sure. So for example, York et al. Show no decoupling, strong rebound effects. Andrew and Brett Clark's wonderful paper that just came out in the AJS in 2012, looking at across both developed and developing countries, shows little evidence of decoupling in either. And we expect that the developed countries would have a lot more decoupling, because in fact what's happening in the developing is they're getting more carbon intensive. They're, each dollar of GDP is tends to use more fossil fuels as a result of the kind of development process they're in. And they looked at three different measures of territorial carbon emissions. Kyle Knight and I have been doing some new work just on OECD countries, looking at both, and I'll introduce this difference now because I'm going to talk about it more in a minute, consumption measures of emissions. So those are the emissions associated with what people in a nation are consuming, so it includes the impacts of imports and exports. So you take out the carbon for the exports and you add in the carbon for the imports. So in a country like the United States, that's very important because we're importing a lot of very carbon-intensive goods, manufactured goods from China. It's also very important in Europe, where they've also exported a lot of their more polluting production to other parts of the world, China especially. So the divergence between the so-called territorial, which are the emissions that you produce in your own territory, so those are your production emissions, and the consumption emissions are growing increasingly important in the wealthy countries. We find a continued strong correlation between GDP growth, so we're looking actually at growth rates and emissions, and no evidence at all of decoupling. So I think decoupling looks more like a hope or an aspiration than something that we're actually seeing in the world. So there's an Austrian research institute that has been now put together a really great database on material intensity of GDP. So they're looking at, it's what's called material flow analysis. It's not done much in the United States, but the Europeans are really starting to do a lot on this. So this includes fossil fuels, but it's all other types of materials too. So it includes wood and biomass and so forth. So this is the question of dematerialization rather than decarbonization. And what they find is you're getting some relative decoupling here in terms of materials intensity of a dollar of GDP. So that's this blue line. This is GDP and this is total material consumption. So you see that while each dollar of GDP is associated with somewhat less materials intensity, materials intensity is rising around the globe. The reductions in both have been on the order of sort of 1 to 1.2% a year over this period in both materials intensity and carbon intensity. And here's just one more graph I want to show you before I get into working hours. And that is looking at growth of CO2 emissions, and these are production-based, and growth in GDP here for countries. And what we see, so this is the zone of absolute decoupling, meaning declines in CO2 emissions. The only countries, and Richard York's done really good work on this, where you see the big declines are the countries whose economies have collapsed. So you have Russia here, which had a big decarbonization, other economies of Eastern Europe too, as a result of the collapse of GDP. You've got Great Britain probably, you know, should be up here once you include its consumption rather than just territorial emissions. What you see here, Germany and France are the other two countries where you've had some success. Germany's had a big transition in energy use, so big, big scale up of renewable energy, solar and wind. But the other thing I want to say about these two countries, and here's my segue into working hours, is there are two things about them. One is they have relatively low GDP growth over this period. And number two, they have very high reductions in working hours. And I think this is really the key to why they've been the only, you know, countries that have been successful in doing this without economic collapse. So I just did want to mention that in the degrowth world, there are a couple of other strands of argument coming together for critiques of growth. I think these people are very familiar with, so I'm just going to move through them quickly. But just to say that the growing field of degrowth, which has both an academic and, I would say, a more advocacy and activist dimension to it, although environmental issues are at its core, they're also talking about things like unemployment or the critique of growth as no longer being, that just growth is no longer the engine of GDP growth, no longer a good engine of job growth. So this idea of jobless growth, and here we can see, you know, a great example in the U.S. beginning in 2010, we're out of recession, but basically no increase in the employment to population ratio. So big weakening in the relationship between job growth and GDP growth in the US and in other places as well. Second is the deviation of productivity growth from wage growth. So the idea that increases in GDP and increases in productivity growth no longer are yielding the kinds of benefits that they did to workers and employees. And this is a particular measure, this production of non-supervisory workers. But you can look at a variety of measures. This is true if you look at college educated as well. Almost all but the very top are not benefiting in terms of wages as a result of this productivity growth. In sharp contrast to the way the way things operated until the mid-1970s. And then, of course, the enormous increases in inequality, and this is just wealth inequality. We could look at income inequality. You've heard, you know, about this ad nauseum at this point, particularly since Occupy. So the relationship between joblessness, unemployment, stagnant incomes, and inequality and growth are all part of what's fueling increasing questioning of growth, and then, of course, the big, now enormous literature on well-being and growth and the idea of the delinking between GDP growth and well-being.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're airing a talk by Juliet Shore, a professor of sociology and economics at Boston College. She spoke about decarbonizing the economy, that is, economic ideas for how society can wean itself off fossil fuel dependency. Juliet Shore says one camp of scholars believe that so-called green growth or economic growth that's decoupled from environmental degradation is possible. But another camp believes economic growth as we know it cannot continue without severely negative environmental degradation and consequences. This camp, Juliet Shore says, argues for an alternative measure to gross domestic product, such as gross national well-being.
So let me turn to work time now. If you are advocating for a slow growth, a steady state, or a degrowth economy, you must also be advocating for reductions in working hours, because there is almost no way to manage that process without really bad outcomes if you don't have reductions in working hours. Now, let me just say why that is. Let's assume you have a stable population. If you have productivity growth, you pretty much have to assume you're going to be having productivity growth. If you have productivity growth and no output growth, you have only two choices if you don't reduce working hours. One is to progressively unemploy people, so you get a growing pool of unemployed. The other is to send your surplus someplace else. Now, you could do that, but you could basically, that becomes a very political problem, because you have a population that's getting more and more productive and it's not seeing any of the benefits of that. They are all going to other countries. Now, we're going to have to do a good bit of that to fund the energy transition in the global south, but it's hard to think about sort of a planned slow growth or a planned steady state in which all of that productivity growth is going elsewhere. So working hours reductions really become absolutely necessary when you think about reductions in growth. Now, just to put this into historical perspective, this is what happened to annual working hours per person from 1870 to about 1973 here. These are a little bit made up numbers. As you can see, they're estimates. We don't have really accurate numbers. But generally speaking, people worked about 3,000 hours a year in 1870. So that's about a 60-hour average work week, working pretty much all year. All of these countries have big declines in working hours over this period. You know, Japan sort of stalls out a little bit, but, you know, everybody is reducing. They're taking a really significant portion of their productivity growth and they're putting it toward shorter hours of work. This is really important because it was central to retaining high employment societies over this period of time. I'm not going to say full employment, because we only achieve full employment in these countries, you know, periodically, and of course we had the Great Depression during this period. But when you think about the level of economic disruption that was going on in terms of new technologies, new products, how many industries got completely wiped out over this period through productivity change and new technologies, the difference in the product mix from 1870 to 1970, just phenomenal levels of technological change and kind of labor market disruption. And a really important part of how that was managed was to reduce working hours. Now, it was done for other reasons too, but employment, maintaining a reasonably balanced labor market was absolutely key to that. The other point I want to make is the U.S. was absolutely the leader here. We were the first to do most of the things that happened in terms of work time reduction, whether it was taking Sundays off and Saturdays off and paid vacations and so forth. So we were out ahead. At the end of the Second World War, we had much shorter working hours than the Europeans. Of course, that turns around. Now, this is what happened since 73 to 2001. Pretty much all of these countries continued on that trajectory, and you have big declines. So, for example, here's the Netherlands, one of the leaders, if not the leader, in work time reduction, from 1800 down to less than 1400 hours a year. Germany, another well-known work time reducer, 1900 down to 1400. The Japanese, of course, reduced their average working hours a lot since about the 1990. But take a look at the United States here, the blue line. We've done very, very little. And this actually overstates what we've done, because this is data from enterprises and doesn't include multiple job holdings. If you look at the household data, we have increases in average hours. And then we also have the big increases on a family basis, where you have the big increases in married women's labor force, married women's both labor force participation, but then also their hours of work. So the U.S. deviates from everybody else over this period. And this is just some, looking at some of the numbers. Here's from 1950, 75 to 2010. And you see the U.S. is really an outlier here in terms of having much reduced a much smaller fraction of its productivity growth taken in the form of shorter hours of work. The Japanese, it's here, because you don't have much of a change from 1950 to 75, but then you get a bigger change after that. The other way to think about it is what fraction of productivity growth is taken in the form of shorter hours. And here we have decrease in hours as a percentage of productivity gains. Again, the United States, very small in comparison to these other countries. You can also see where some countries start to get into trouble. Here's Italy, which took a lot more working hour reduction than it could afford, and is now not in the best shape economically. But for the most part, countries are funding this working hour reduction out of productivity growth. What that means is that they are growing more slowly, because your productivity growth has to go to either, you can use it either to expand your output or to reduce your working hours. Those are basically the two things that you could do with it. So that's the kind of backdrop in which I started thinking about working hours and their relationship to carbon emissions. And I want to turn now to the analyses which look at how working hours relate to environmental outcomes. And this is based on a paper that I did with Jean Rosa and Kyle Knight. And we're looking at EF, which is ecological footprint, carbon footprint, which is the carbon dimension, carbon footprint part of eco-footprint. These are consumption-based measures. And then carbon emissions, which is the territorial-based or production-based emissions. So the basic idea, the hypothesis, is that countries with shorter hours of work will have lower levels of ecological degradation and lower levels of carbon footprint and carbon emissions. So that's the theory. And why is it that we think that? I'll get to that. Let me just say a little something about the work that had been done before ours. I had done a little study in 2005 looking at this. My students, Anders Hayden and John Chandra, did a cross-sectional study of 45 countries looking at eco-footprints and hours. Dave Rosnick and Mark Weisbrot from the Center for Economic Policy Research in D.C. did a study of hours and energy use, estimating elasticity estimates for the U.S. and Europe. How much does energy use change with working hour changes? And basically argued that a big part of the difference in carbon footprints between the U.S. or carbon emissions between the U.S. and Europe was due to their shorter hours of work. Rosnick has a new piece where he takes an IPCC scenarios and says, okay, what if we reduce hours by 0.5% per year? What impact is that going to have on warming? And then there have been a few household level studies which look at household level carbon emissions, but not the greatest data with hours of work, and find that households with higher hours of work tend to have higher emissions. So the modeling strategy we have is to look at 29 OECD countries. We have a panel from 1970 to 2007. And I should say a word about why we're just looking at the OECD countries. And that's because the discourse of degrowth is all about the rich countries. No one is arguing that poor countries should not grow. I think everyone in this debate understands that ecological space is owed to poor countries, that you have high levels of energy poverty in poor countries, as well as other kinds of poverty, and that it's imperative for countries with lots of poor people to be able to expand the resources available to those people. So the degrowth story is about why the wealthy countries need to stop growing to allow the poor countries the ecological space to grow. So we're looking at high-income OECD countries. We're using World Bank data for most of the economic variables. The Global Footprint Network, which calculates the ecological footprint and the carbon footprint, and then World Resources Institute, which from where we got the territorial carbon emissions. We're using a stochastic version of IPAT, which Gene Rosa developed with his collaborators, and that they call that STIRPAT, stochastic IPAT. And we have a first differences model. So there are two, I said a few minutes ago, why is it that, and I should have switched these slides around, why is it that we would think shorter working hours would be associated with lower levels of emissions? There are two effects that you can hypothesize. The first one is the scale effect, and that goes to the point I talked about a few minutes earlier, which is what are you doing with your productivity growth? Are you using it to increase output or to reduce hours of work? The more hours reductions you have, ceteris paribus, the slower your rate of output growth, the lower your rate of output growth should be, so that the scale of your economy should be expanding more slowly. And that we call the scale effect. So you'll have a lower growth rate if you do more hours reductions for any given level of productivity growth, and as I say, holding everything else constant. So think of it this way, if you have fixed hours of work and you have productivity growth, it means you're going to increase your output and consumption. You're gonna have to rely just on technology change to reduce your ecological impact. This is back to the rebound point, which in the rebound point is saying technological change will do it. But the problem is that technology change yields productivity growth, which then increases this. So that's part of the rebound process. So in our story, you have productivity growth. If it reduces hours of work, you get less growth in output, and you should have a bigger reduction in ecological impact. So that's the visual representation of the hypothesis. The second hypothesis comes from household behavior change, and it relies on the insights of people like Gary Becker, Kelvin Lancaster, thinking about what households are maximizing. Now, in the sort of conventional practice in terms of thinking about households and consumption is to focus on income and wealth. And maybe then other demographic variables. Even though Becker, sort of said to us all the way back in the 1960s, remember the time budget too, because households have income budgets and time budgets. And the when we start to think about time budgets, we get some interesting new ideas about how people behave. So a kind of standard hypothesis would be that if households are more time poor, they will have to do things in faster ways, or they will prefer to do things in faster ways. And there's a strong association between speed of practices and fossil fuel use. Transportation being the most obvious and most important, the faster you want to get somewhere, the more carbon you emit. Unless you're using some kind of alternative, renewable energy or something. So the idea is that time-scarce households have higher carbon emissions or and higher eco footprints, ceteris paribus. You can also think about things other than transportation. Do-it-yourself practices, which tend to take time. A lot of the things that people are urged to do to be sustainable at a household level are quite time-consuming. And so we hypothesize that there is, and you know, we don't, this research needs to be done to take that input-output matrix of environmental impacts and look at it in relationship to time use. Very complicated thing. There are a few European studies where they've tried to look at a couple of sectors like eating. So for example, if you want to get your food prepared fastest, you know, the highest level of processed food, higher carbon intensity than doing more scratch cooking, for example, or maybe even growing your own food, etc. So that trade-off between time use and ecological outcomes. So we have what we call the compositional effect hypothesis, which is that higher working hours yield more ecologically and carbon-intensive household activities. And this is just an example of two time-intensive but low eco-intensive activities. So as I mentioned, our dependent variables are the ecological footprint. And for those of you who don't know about that, it's the land and sea area necessary to produce an annual consumption measured. You can measure it by country. You can also do household eco-footprints, eco-footprints of companies, of cities, etc. The carbon footprint, which is just the carbon component of the eco-footprint, and the carbon component is the land required to sequester the carbon emitted. So they think of it as you're emitting a certain amount of carbon, and then you need those forests to sequester it. And then, of course, the territorial carbon emissions that we talked about. So these are our, so what we're going to do is we're going to explain these three eco impacts by looking at working hours as well as GDP per person, population, and then just some standard variables that are usually in these kinds of models, urbanization, percent manufacturing, percent service, etc. And let me just move to the results here because I only have 5 minutes left. So we have to, the strategy of the modeling, and these are the eco footprint, carbon footprint, and CO2. The strategy of the modeling is first to include the to take out the GDP per capita here and decompose it into its component parts, which is work hours, employment. Over population ratio and productivity per hour, GDP per hour. So we decompose GDP into those three dimensions, and then we test for the composition effect by also putting in the GDP per person in this model too, where we have work hours and GDP per person. And here are the three, or the all three of them. So what you see is for eco footprint, for in all three models, the scale effect is very strong, and that's measured here by working hours. So a 1.37 percentage increase in or decrease in working hours gives you a 1% decrease in eco footprint, and the carbon footprint is a pretty similar. Of course, territorial emissions, as we would expect, have a weaker relationship with working hours because they are, you're looking at the territorial emissions are not really giving you the true consumption emissions of your country because you're picking up a lot of the, you know, what is the carbon intensity of another place. So as expected, working hours are still significant, but they have about, you know, less than half the impact. And then I'll end by saying I focused on shorter hours and eco and carbon footprints, but it turns out shorter hours are what we think of as a triple dividend solution, because they also have impacts on unemployment. Shorter hours lead to more job creation. They also give people a real benefit, which is more free time. They reduce stress, enhance family life and community. And so I think there's a politics of shorter hours that goes beyond just, let's do this to save the environment, but in fact is, this is a kind of economic policy direction that can yield widespread, broadly shared benefits across the population and address some of those other key dimensions of the growth critique that I raised, which is inequality, joblessness, and quality of life.
You've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour and a recorded talk by Professor of Sociology and Economics, Juliet Shore. We have a link to her website, julietshore.org, on our website, where you can learn more about Juliet Shore's work and publications. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. Join us every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss. This is KCPW.